So welcome everyone to our JCC Coffee, Cake, and Learning pre-Tisha B'Av, ninth of Av class, Tears for Fears. And I want to dedicate the class, the learning should be for a very special lady who passed away last night, Jean Shiewitz. You may have heard the news. She made it to 98 years old, and she passed away last night. And so the funeral is going to be tomorrow. So again, we should dedicate it to her, Ruth Bat Moshe. So historically, the Tisha B'Av has a connotation of the day that has been established for all generations, as we'll see in a moment, as a day of weeping, of tears. So what's the genesis of this day? Why did the day of the ninth of Av become a day where, as we nested history, that class that we had, as history plays out, we see that within the confines of history, you have all these very bad things that happen, both to the Jewish people uniquely and a little bit to the world. Like they say, World War I began on Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av. We talked about the expulsion from Spain in 1492. July 31st was the ninth of Av, etc., etc. So there's a lot there. So let's look at the first time that this is brought up in the context of tears that were shed out of either fear or a misunderstanding. So in the Bible, in the book of Numbers, it says that the Jewish people, leave it to the Jews to kvetch, they always like to complain. So they began to have strong cravings for meat. They were in the desert, there weren't a lot of Wise Markets or Wegmans, I guess, available at the time. So they were bothered and troubled. And it said they began to have strong cravings, urges for some real food. Then even the children of Israel once again began to cry. So they're shedding tears. And they said, "Who will feed us meat? We remember the fish that we ate in Egypt free of charge. The cucumbers, the watermelons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic." Very specific. "But now," they said, "our bodies are dried out, for there's nothing at all. We have nothing but manna to look at." What? What? Do you hear the insanity on so many levels of this statement? Okay, let's pick it apart. Okay, number one. Jews are slaves for 116 years of actual servitude and beyond, okay? Do you think the Egyptians are making them delicious, you know, chef-made smoked salmon there by the Nile River while they are being whipped to death by the taskmasters? They wouldn't even give them extra straw to make the grain. But no. Delicacies and fish, I'm sure they had a couple hours because they were union members. Yeah, right. And they had a couple hours for a nice luxurious lunch. And they're remembering all this delicious fish that we had, free of charge. Free of charge. Okay. And then they remember some vegetables, you know, the onions, the garlics. And then they say, "Oh, but the manna bread from heaven, that's all we have. It's junk." Do you hear the difficulty? Like, what's going on? So let's take the verse and let's analyze it piece by piece. To say that the manna bread from heaven is junk is, it defies logic. It's incredible. What a statement. And to ascribe, which they're doing, the slavery of Egypt and that any food they got as a result of the slavery as being free of charge is lunatic. It's lunatic. So even if they got some type of fish for free, that's how you, so in other words, you're being whipped and punished, you're in the gulag, but the little meal they gave you, it came at no cost, it's free. So on so many levels, this is an insane statement. Would you all agree? Yeah? I mean, it's crazy. This is, the rabbis say, the first moment of the percolating of a very dark cup of coffee that you don't want to drink, called sinas chinam, or just chinam. Non-reality. Because this is not a real statement. It can't be. In other words, first of all, it cost them their lives their skin, their children, everything you can imagine as being slaves. And secondarily, to say that the manna, okay, I understand that it's a little bit like astronaut food. You know, I think astronaut food basically can taste like a lot of magical things, but you might not get the pleasure of like tearing the meat in your mouth. And part of the pleasure of eating is if you're eating, let's say, I don't know, oatmeal for breakfast, and the oatmeal, it always has the substance of oatmeal, but it tastes like a myriad of different things, it would still be lacking, right? You don't want your pizza to feel like oatmeal. You don't want your grilled chicken and potatoes to have the substance of, part of the enjoyment of eating the food is that actually you chew it and it feels. So I understand maybe they're a little tired, a little tedious of manna bread every day. But my gosh, they could bake it. It would taste like, if you did nothing, by the way, to the manna, it tasted like dough fried in honey. Zero calories, by the way. They didn't even have to excrete it. So it's a perfect food. It was digested 100% by your body. If I offered anybody here, I don't know about you, but I offered you as many donuts and brownies you want to eat every day, zero calories, zero cholesterol, I think I'd get some takers, yeah? I think I'd get a world of takers. It'd be the best diet food of all time. You'd be very wealthy, okay, if you had such a food to offer with no deleterious side effects. So what do we see from this statement? That this is not real. Both the memory they have, Egypt, copious amounts of fish, it's a fake out. It's not true. So that's number one. And then the way they view the manna is also fake. It's not real. So therefore, on different levels, we see already the beginnings of this idea of non-reality. And it gets worse. Source two. So this is from the Tractate Sanhedrin in the Babylonian Talmud. So it says like this. She weeps, yea, she weeps in the night. Why this double weeping? Why isn't one cry enough? Rabbah, great rabbinical Amora, Talmudic scholar, said in Rabbi Yochanan's name, another great, even greater Talmudic scholar, once we cry, means once when it says she weeps, it's for the first temple in Jerusalem, Solomon's temple. And once we cry for the second temple that was rebuilt in the aftermath, 70 years after Solomon's was destroyed. First one by the Babylonians, second one by the Romans. In the night, why does it say she weeps in the night? What does that mean? On account of what happened historically at night in the Bible. For it is written in the Bible, in the Torah, in Numbers, and all the congregation of the Jewish people lifted up their voice and cried. And the people wept that night. Rabbah, this rabbi observed in Rabbi Yochanan's name, well, what night was it? It was the night of the ninth of Av, Tisha B'Av, which is based, our class is based upon. And the Almighty said to Israel, God says to Israel, you have wept without cause, without justification. Therefore, God says, therefore will I, God, appoint a weeping to you for future generations. And it's not spoken out here, but he's saying for legitimate reasons. Wow. So we have to unpackage this. So in Parsha Shlach, we had a class about this, you may remember. We had the incident, the horrible sin of the spies, the Meraglim. The 12 men were sent to the land of Canaan, land of Israel, before it was called Israel. And they were supposed to like scout out the land, bring back a report to Moses and Aaron and to Joshua and Caleb went. 10 other men went. Joshua and Caleb were honorable and truthful, but the other 10 men maligned the land of Israel and brought this horrific report that it's a land that eats up its inhabitants with giants. Let's go back to Egypt. This is all garbage. And of course, what did the people do in response to this nefarious report? They cried. So God is hearing their cries, which we just heard in the section 2, source 2. And then God says, wait a minute, you're crying? I don't understand. You're on the precipice of the promised land, yeah? I'm about to take you into Israel, and we're going to vanquish all those Canaanites, and you're going to settle the land of Israel. And your response should be simcha, should be joy. I should be hearing trumpets and laughter. You're crying over what? Over a report that's not real? A manufactured report that's bogus? Wow. So you know what God says? Oh, okay. No. Let's have it your way then. If you want to cry tonight, which was the ninth of Av, for illegitimate reasons, I will dedicate this night for all generations that you will cry for legitimate reasons. It won't be for nothing. It won't be for non-reality. It'll be real. So in other words, that night became the ninth of Av, where we would cry over the loss of the temples and the expulsion from Spain and all these horrific things over the generations. We, the Jewish people of that generation, we caused the ninth of Av to be transformed from what should have been a holiday, a festival, a day of laughter and joy. But no, because of our illegitimate cry, God said, have it your way. I'll make it a night of weeping. That's the ninth of Av. Wow. So you see very clearly that the non-reality of the cry, and it's described this way, b'chiyah shel chinam, a wailing, a crying, that is chinam, not real, free. Oh my gosh, but that's the same word we used when we described eating the fish in Egypt, remember, for free. What does free mean then? Free doesn't mean like get out of jail free. Free means free from reality. It's not real. That's what chinam means, free from reality. So this is the source then of the misery of the people. That, in other words, God is responding apropos to how we feel and respond to his world. And if we respond in an illegitimate way, then God has to legitimize our response. It's an incredible idea. Okay, so now let us go a little further into the weeds of the ninth of Av, okay? And we're going to speak now about the concept of tears for fear. So it is entirely not only appropriate, but hardwired into human nature that we are fearful of our future. We always are. That's why you have life insurance and retirement. We don't know. So it's legitimate to have fears of health concerns, etc. That's normal. Absolutely hardwired into the human psyche. However, when you have irrational fears, or when things are out of our control and we literally cannot change certain things about aging and what will be down the pike, we can't know. All we can do is try to prepare the best we can, make sensible, reasonable choices in our lives, and God willing, he'll protect us and help us, because some things are just beyond our control, right? So we have to pray for Hashem's help to protect us from those things that could damage us that are out of our control. But there's a concept here that the rabbis bring, which is a very powerful idea. It says in Pirkei Avot, in the ethics of our fathers, Ezehu Chacham, who is the wise individual? Haroeh et hanolad, one who's able to see the future, or what might be the future. In other words, we don't have the crystal ball of Madame Zushka, but we can reasonably make 100% good effort to try to say, oh, well, if I eat XYZ and I know that I'm allergic to that food, probably in a couple hours I'm going to regret my food choices. It's a byproduct of my lifestyle and my choices that I make. So some things are under our control, some are not. But if you think about your own life and my life and the life of our people, it is always an astounding feature of life. And sometimes it's for laughter and sometimes it's unfortunately for tears, where we will say in a response to a situation that just develops, we'll say, oh my gosh, I did not see that one coming. Who could have thought that that mistake, the word I said, the friendship I developed, the enemy I made, boy, I did not see the end result. So again, we're not infallible. We're not Hashem. We're not God. He doesn't expect us to know everything. But haro'et hanolad means there are certain things that one could stop, like you could just take a remote control and push the pause button and say, okay, now I really need to think this through. Before I make a rash decision, before I make that phone call, before I have that meeting with this person, there are potential pratfalls ahead, and I have to be careful to navigate this. And I'm sure if you think about your own lives, right? I think about my life. When you don't think and you act just in the moment, without thinking, without a thought process, without maybe taking a night and another day and another night to think it through and say, oh, okay, you know, before I go ahead, I really want to think this through. I want to go to someone I trust and value and get their opinion, what their insight is. Should I or should I not be involved? That's a fantastic thing. So the story that we're going to have now is going to be three little stories, and I'll tell you all three. I'm not going to tell you in depth. It's more fun to do them outside. But they all are interrelated because they're going to drive home one clear, unassailable fact that we should not act without thought. What will my action or inaction result in? And if we would do better, if I will do better and we'll all do better, and if our world does a little better, just to, you know, as my late uncle Art Oliver Shalom used to say, the best words of all time were the words he never said. Or he used to say it more funny. He used to say, better say nothing and let people think you're an idiot than to open your mouth and to prove them right. I heard that from my dear uncle Art. Okay, so, and it's, by the way, it's really true, right? I mean, it's really true. How often do we feel a need to weigh in? And we're like, oh my gosh, that, you know, I thought that was a very funny little quip, but it didn't go over well. Silence was the response. Okay, so here's source number three. I'll just read source three. You can read with me, and then I'll tell you the story outside. It's more fun that way. Rabbi Yochanan, the same who we quoted a moment ago, the author of the Jerusalem Talmud, he said, what is illustrative? I love that word. Of the verse, Ashrei, happy is the man or woman, the person that fears always, but he who hardens his heart will fall into evil. It's brought down in Tanakh, in our Torah, that happy is the man who always is fearful, but whoever hardens their heart and doesn't fear will inevitably fall into evil. I just added a few words to make it more accessible. As a result of the incident involving Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, Jerusalem was destroyed. Because of a rooster and a hen, Tur Malka was destroyed. And because of the shaft of a sedan, could be a Cadillac Sedan DeVille that was hit, Beitar was destroyed. So before I take you into the Kamsa Bar Kamsa, let's analyze this. So there is a quote. It is incumbent upon all of us to be a little fearful about the future and to think things through, as we just said. But if we harden our heart, meaning if we're just like, no, I don't think things through, I just act. Really? If you harden your heart and you don't see the message from God or what could be the inevitability of our action or inaction, then you're going to fall into evil. That's exactly what he says. So there's three events that caused calamity of the highest order to the Jewish people. So we'll talk about the story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa in a moment. But the other two stories are not as famous. One is a story, you gotta love this one, a rooster and a hen. So right away when you hear a rooster and a hen, you're thinking foghorn, leghorn. Pay attention, my boy, you know? All right, so you're thinking a rooster and a hen. What a dumb premise for a story. What happened? Turamalka was destroyed. What was Turamalka? It was a very lavishly rich area of Judah, in ancient Israel, and here's the story. They had a fertility rite. The fertility rite was when a young couple would get engaged, they would dedicate a rooster and a hen to sort of represent the guy and the girl. You know, they I guess chickens, they lay eggs every day, so they're pretty fertile. And what they would do is they would sort of grow the rooster and the hen sort of as a accompaniment to the wedding, and the poor rooster and hen would get eaten, I guess, at the meal, at the wedding feast. But it would be like a fertility rite, meaning we're wishing the young couple, Kein Yirbu, Pru Revu Milu Et Haaretz, be fruitful and multiply and fill up the land. Yeah? Okay. So a couple Roman soldiers did not know about the fertility rite, but they were hungry, and their local Roman KFC was not around. And they were, what do they know? They're coming up near a farm in Turamalka, and they see some hens and chickens and roosters lying, you know, flying around, making a lot of noise. They decide, hey, we can have a little barbecue. So they took a couple of roosters and hens and things that were dedicated for a wedding that was coming up, and they had lunch. The citizens of that little town were irate And they started to pelt the Roman soldiers with stones. They attacked them physically. It's not a good idea on many levels, because you can imagine the seniority of the Romans did not take well to the Jews of this little town in Toramalca firing upon their soldiers. This is not a good thing. As a result, the soldiers were let loose on the citizens of Toramalca, and thousands were killed over a rooster and a hen. You see how inconsequential? You talk about rabbi says you have to see the future, that over a rooster. It's trivia beyond trivial. Okay. Second story. The broken fender on a sedan. What is that about? Okay. Apparently, a royal member of Caesar's extended family, not Julius or Anthony and Cleopatra. We don't know who exactly this young lady was. She was touring around Beitar, which was located outside of Jerusalem, and it was an incredible Jewish population center. And she is being taken in a carriage. Some say it was a litter. A litter is one of those carriages that's like carried on the shoulders of very strong Arnold Schwarzenegger type soldiers, And apparently somehow there was a traffic accident and the fender of the sedan of the litter got broken. Okay. So they're looking around and Chaim's auto repair shop is not around and accessible to them. But they look over and they see some wood that is drying out. Cedar wood. Now, unbeknownst to the Roman Secret Service agents who are protecting Her Royal Highness, that cedar had been just newly cut down from a cedar tree that was planted at the birth of a young Jewish man. And the custom was they would plant two different types of trees, one for a guy, one for a girl. When they grew up and got married, they cut the tree down, dry the wood, and they would make the chuppah, their wedding canopy, from the wood of that tree. It's a beautiful concept, right? The Romans didn't know that cedar had been designated for a wedding. They just knew that Her Royal Highness's chariot was broken and they needed to make a repair fast. So again, the citizens of Beitar went nuts, pelting Caesar's princess with tomatoes, whatever. It was not a good thing. So you can imagine when Caesar and Brutus, maybe, I'm joking, when they get the message that the Jews are pelting the girl, the princess, it's just impossible. And therefore they let the lions and the gladiators descend upon the Jews of Beitar. And again, thousands lost their lives over a broken fender. Incredible, right? Now the most famous story, which we have learned a little bit in the past, that's why I'm going to do it outside. Story of these two guys, Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. So before I tell you the story, just to drive home the point that I've already made about little inconsequential events, we say, oh my gosh, I didn't see that one coming. Wow, right? My own rabbi, Rabbi Weinberg, cites the idea that the word Kamsa has an actual meaning in the Talmud. You know what it means? A bug, like an insect. You talk about little and inconsequential, something you can just crush. So a Kamsa, then, is a bug. What would that make a bar kamsa? A bar is ben, a son of, like a bar mitzvah. So he's not even a bug. He's just the son of a bug. So it's like the rabbis are really driving the point home. Because in other words, they're changing the names of the people involved, because I guess they don't want to speak lashon hara, bad speech about whoever these guys were. And they're basically, so whether or not they really were named kamsa or bar kamsa, but we're giving them these fake names, maybe just to protect the innocent or the guilty. And we're saying there was a story about a bug and a son of a bug. And because of that, the temple was destroyed. What? Like, what's going on here? This is not a good story. Okay? Here's the story. There was a man, very wealthy Jew, living in Jerusalem under Roman occupation. We don't know the identity of this man. So let's just call him Zuckerberg. So Zuckerberg, Jewish guy, right? Zuckerberg is a very affluent guy. And he has a best pal and bosom buddy named Barney Rebel Kamsa. His best pal is this guy Kamsa. And then he has a hated enemy, Bar Kamsa. So again, rich Jew, anonymous guy, best pal Kamsa, hated enemy Bar Kamsa. The rich guy decides to throw the feast of the year. It's in Jerusalem, so he's inviting Roman dignitaries to show honor to them. The rabbis are invited, and the people of Jerusalem and beyond are invited to this lavish feast. He goes to his dim-witted, I'm only adding that because it seems he's a little dim-witted, as you'll hear. He goes to his dim-witted personal butler, and he says, you know, I want you to go to my dear pal, Kamsa, and I want you to invite him personally that he should attend my feast. Okay, so the guy goes, and he's walking, and he gets a little confused. Did he say Kamsa or Bar Kamsa? So instead of asking, going back and saying, excuse me, boss, who are we inviting? Somehow he went to Bar Kamsa and said, excuse me, my boss, Zuckerberg, is extending a personal royal invitation to you to attend the lavish feast of the year at the palatial resort of, you know, the Hyatt Regency Jerusalem. Okay. So Bar Kamsa is probably a little shell-shocked because he knows he's not the favorite of Zuckerberg, of this guy. But I'm just throwing an idea. Maybe he thinks, well, this must be he's reaching out. He's making a rapprochement, like an olive leaf. He's inviting me to the meal. Must be that he wants me to attend because he wants to put the past in the past. So Bar Kamsa decides to come. So he gets dressed up for the feast, and he gets there early. He's there before Zuckerberg, before the host shows up. And the host comes in, and he's looking around. It's just lavish beyond words. And he sees, with a big grin and a smile, Bar Kamsa sitting at one of the head tables with a big smile. And he's noticeable because no one else is there yet. And people are just arriving. There's a red carpet outside. The paparazzi are taking pictures of all the people as they come in, you know. It's a big event. So the guy looks, and he looks again, and he thinks, oy vey, like what's going on? What is this guy doing here? And so he walks over to the guy. And this is the craziest part of the story. Rather than just react like you and I would react, all right? How would you react? You'd be a little upset, to say the least. You'd be like, what are you doing here? And we expect that type of visceral reaction. No, he doesn't react that way. You know what he does? He comes over and he almost like thinks it through with like Talmudic logic. So he says, and this is the key that something else is going on. This is how the Talmud phrases it. Ready? He says, let's think about this for a moment. Doesn't that man have a hated enemy, that guy? Who's the man? Isn't that you? And who's the other guy? Isn't that Bar Kamsa? So in other words, why would he react almost like it's third person? Doesn't that man have a hated enemy who happens to be this guy? He should just say in first person, you're my hated enemy, why are you here? But he doesn't do it that way. Like there's this little weird thought process. I'll come back to that in a minute. So he says to Bar Kamsa, what are you doing here? So at that moment, Bar Kamsa is not a fool. He realizes some miscommunication happened. So he says, look, I realize I'm here in error, but everybody else is here now. The rabbis, the Romans, the rest of the Jewish community, the nouveau riche. So I understand it's a mistake. Here's my Canaanite express card. I guess it would be Roman, right? The Roman visa. Here's my credit card. I'll pay for whatever I eat and drink. Please just let me go quietly into the night after everyone is occupied somewhere else. Owner looks at him and says, get out. Okay, I get it. I'll pay for half the costs of everything. The hall, the food, the security. Just let me stay and I'll slink away later. Get out. Okay. I'll pay for everything. Please, don't throw me out in front of everybody. Don't do this to me. Rich guy snaps his hands, snaps his fingers. Nunzio Guido, the Romans, come over and they unceremoniously pick up Bar Kamsa physically. And they walk him through the whole hall, through in front of everybody there. They open the doors and they just unceremoniously toss him out onto the dirt in front of the paparazzi and everybody who's there. Wow. So Bar comes up, gets up, dusts himself off, and now we get into the mind of Bar Kamsa. Yeah? So Bar Kamsa says, look, he says, the rabbis, of course it's always the rabbis' fault, doesn't blame the Romans or everybody else. The rabbis saw my embarrassment and shame, and instead of standing up for me and forcing Zuckerberg to do the right thing by me, they said nothing. I'm going to kill all the rabbis and the Jews. Now he's a Jew himself, Bar Kamsa. He's one of ours. So he happens to have a connection to Caesar. So he requests an audience with Caesar himself. Now, we don't know if it's not the guy in Rome. It's probably one of Caesar's underlings who's in charge of Palestine, because that's what they renamed it at that time. So he has an audience, and he says to Caesar's representative, he says, the Jews are rebelling against you. So Caesar knows this guy, Bar Kamsa, you know, is a no-goodnik. So he says, I'm not going to take your word for it. I'm not an idiot. How do you know? Prove to me that the Jews are rebelling against Roman authority. He said, oh, very simple. You think the Jews actually care about you and show you honor and respect? It's not true. He says, all you have to do, send with me the finest, fattest, beautiful little calf and say, this is a gift from Rome for your temple. And let's see how they react. Will they offer it on their altar or not? That's how they really feel about you or not. So Caesar thinks, oh, okay, that's a reasonable test. So he gets the finest, most fattened little calf, and he sends him with Bar Kamsa and some guards. So they're on their way up to Jerusalem. Okay. He's a sneaky guy, Bar Kamsa. He takes out his Swiss Army knife when no one's watching. And he makes a slight little cut, either in the lip of the calf or around the eye of the calf. And when the rabbis would bring a sacrifice, a korban, because it had to be tamim, absolutely perfect, they had like an electron microscope, and they would put the calf, you know, under scrutiny to make sure it was exactly tamim. It had to be 100% pure. So the place that he did the little tear was a place that to a Roman is inconsequential. But Bar Kamsa, devious, wicked man that he was, knew that the rabbis would catch it and could not bring this as a sacrifice. That's his plan. Because then Caesar's going to hear that the Jews don't really respect you because they don't bring a beautiful sacrifice. The rabbis can't argue that it wasn't fit because to the Romans it's perfect, right? So this is his plan. So he brings the calf and the rabbis take the calf and they put it under a microscope. And the rabbis look, and sure enough, they find the little blemish, the tiny little blemish. And they get together, and they decide, well, what should we do? So the rabbis get up at the meeting, and they say, look, this is horrible. Normally, we never would bring such an animal. It's an issue. But we also know this is extraordinary, because it's Bar Kamsa. We know what he's like. He's plotting to do this. It's all part of the plan. We have to one time make an allowance, and we have to offer the calf. Because otherwise, wow, we could all be blown away by the Romans. We don't know how Caesar's going to react. This is a very reasonable approach, right? There was one rabbi named Rabbi Zachariah. And Rabbi Zachariah gets up and says, no, you can't bring it. Well, why not, Rabbi Zachariah? Because if you bring it, the word will get out. You know what the Jewish people are like? It's on Twitter, on X. Word will get out that we made an allowance and that it's going to diminish the prestige of the temple and God. Can't do it. So the rabbis respect this Rabbi Zachariah. So they get back together and they have a huddle again. And they decide, okay, Rabbi Zachariah forbids us from bringing the animal. We have to kill Bar Kamsa. We're going to hire a couple Sicilian, this is a great story, right? We're going to hire a couple Sicilian guys, Nunzio and Guido, a couple guys work for Don Corleone, and we'll whack him. And that way Bar Kamsa won't be able to go back to Caesar and report that we didn't bring it, because he's dead. And after all, by Torah law, by the law of the Bible, if somebody's coming to murder you, you are allowed to take their life in advance. They already are like a dead man walking. This guy's coming ostensibly to murder all the Jews, so it is not only our right, it's our obligation. If we can't bring the sacrifice, because it's been vetoed by Rabbi Zachariah, then at least we have to stop the report from going back to Caesar. Again, Rabbi Zachariah gets up and says, no, you can't kill Bar Kamsa. They say, why not? Because I understand he's a bad guy. But when word will get out to the people that we killed a man because he took a little knife and made a blemish in an animal, they won't know about the other part. They're going to get the wrong law. They'll say, oh, if you make a blemish, a mum on a sacrifice, you're chayiv misa, you get killed. That's not true. So unfortunately, Rabbi Zachariah vetoed both approaches. So guess what they did? Nothing. So they said, no, we will not bring it. And then they did not kill or hinder poor Bar Kamsa when he went back to Caesar. You know the rest of the story. Caesar destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. Wow. Haroa et anolat. We said, you should be fearful, according to the verse. Remember? That somebody who fears the future, who's scared, who is a mefache tami, who's always fearful about what might happen, that person is happy, is praiseworthy. But one who hardens their heart from something obvious that will come to be, that person will fall into evil. So the rabbi said, wait a minute. But Rabbi Zachariah, he is the epitome of the fearful guy, right? Because think about it. He's so fearful, he won't bring the animal for fear that people will get the wrong impression about an animal sacrifice. But he also won't kill, he won't sanction the killing of Bar Kamsa, even to protect the Jews, because he's fearful what people might think. So isn't he the epitome of a guy who's always fearful? So why are you taking him because the rabbis say he's to blame. His decision-making or lack thereof caused the destruction. Isn't he the example of someone so fearful? He's like, oh, I can't do that. I can't. No, the rabbis say. No. You see, you should be fearful, but don't stop being fearful. Don't let your fear stop here. Just let it go. So if you would say to Rabbi Zachariah, okay, Rabbi, we love you. I get your arguments. You're worried about what people might think, the Jewish people, about sacrifices. Can I bring an animal with a blemish? Do you kill someone and people might think it's over making a blemish on an animal? I get that, Rabbi. If you don't do one of these two things, no one is even going to remember the laws of sacrifices. You know why? Because there won't be a temple to bring sacrifices. They're going to nuke us because of this. But that he wasn't worried about, right? He was worried up to a point. He defined his worry stopped here when his worry should have kept going. Oh my gosh, if we don't do one of these two reasonable actions, it'll be a moot point next year about sacrifices, schmacrifices. We're not going to be here and there won't be a temple. Wow. So you see that our approach has to be based in reality. So getting back to Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, all three of these cases, the insane people who attack Caesar's daughter because of a broken fender without going to the next step and saying, oh my gosh, what will be their end result? How will Caesar behave if his daughter is pelted with tomatoes? Or the rooster and the hen. Oh my gosh, if you attack Caesar's soldiers because of a fertility right that went awry, you think that might have consequences for the Jewish people? If you don't allow Bar Kamsa's blemished animal or kill Bar Kamsa, what might the end result be there? No. So that's the, you see how all three of these stories fit together. Inconsequential, dumb little things. Someone getting his nose out of a joint because he's at a party, and it causes these horrific things to happen. And again, there's no defense of Bar Kamsa. The reason the rabbis did not stand up to defend Bar Kamsa, do you see what a horrific person he is? Now, maybe they shouldn't have allowed him to be publicly embarrassed. That was wrong. But a guy who immediately says, after he's embarrassed, well, I want to kill all the Jews. And you're a Jew. This is how you react? You have a diabolical plot with Caesar to kill the Jewish people and destroy our temple because you got your nose out of joint over an accidental invitation? So in other words, if you knew Bar Kamsa, there would probably be a commandment, a mitzvah in the Torah, to hate his guts until he repents from his evil ways. He's a horrible guy. But guess what? The rabbis say in the Talmud, God helped the actions, the plan of Bar Kamtza come to fruition because he was publicly shamed. We have to be so careful. Even when we're right about someone doing something, we never shame them and embarrass them in public. So what's the end result? Tears for fears. God says, you cried the night of the night of Av when you heard the report of the spies and you should have been celebrating. I'm going to establish for you moments in the future where you're going to cry for legitimate reasons. But you see in our little story how we lost the temple and the Jews were killed in Torah Malka and in Beitar because of the Romans. We see this as an end result of people who, again, have tears or fears that are misplaced. They're not based on reality. It's over manna. It's over a fish that I remember being... There are always issues that are baseless, whether it's baseless hatred. And by the way, I never explained this because I left it for the end. Remember that weird little part of the story? And I'm wrapping up now. Remember the weird thing where he thinks out of sight of himself, well, doesn't this rich man have a guy who's his good friend and this guy who's an enemy? Like, why isn't he reacting more viscerally? Do you know why? Because the Zuckerberg guy, the host, he didn't have any bad feelings towards Bar Kamtza. He didn't really know Bar Kamtza. But his best pal, Kamtza, hated Bar Kamtza. And the rich guy wants to be friends with Kamtza. So out of a fidelity to the relationship that he has with Kamtza, the rich guy tosses Bar Kamtza out of his party. He doesn't have any evil feelings. So what could be more non-real? What could be not more fake? Then he's not reacting, or the Talmud is telling us, he's not reacting the way we would react if there was somebody who had damaged us and we would have like a grievance. No, he's reacting cerebrally. Oh, don't I have an enemy? Or shouldn't I have to have a bad guy because I like Kamtza? Shouldn't this guy Bar Kamtza be also my enemy? Well, that's not true. He wasn't your enemy, but you treated him like that. So what's the end result? We live in a world right now of chinam, of fake, false reality. There's no greater false reality than the way people perceive Israel and the Jewish people at this point. And it's hard to fight because it's been by design, right? Post October 7th, the world has created an illusion of a nation that are colonialists and apartheidists and genociders and keep going. I mean, whatever other little things they throw at us. And anyone who's visited Israel, anyone who goes and sees the facts on the ground. Now, doesn't mean Israel's perfect. When you fight a war, by design, Hamas created a war that could not be fought. And they took our hostages underground to this tunnel system they built over 25 years with the help of North Korea, knowing that there's no way those Jews and the IDF, who are so holier than thou, they're not going to try to come in and have collateral damage and kill. We're going to build these tunnels under hospitals and under mosques and under schools because there's no way they can come in and get their poor hostages. We'll just keep them forever underground. And the Israeli soldiers will be impotent. They can't do anything because we know Israel's moral. They're not going to fight a war like this. But we fought the war. But what a cost it came as. So that was Hamas's plan B, right? They're like Bar Kamtza, they have a plan B. Plan B is, well, even if they come in and really eventually root us out, it will cause such a PR nightmare for the Jews and for Israel that we win either way. We can't lose. They're willing to martyr themselves. You know, if they really want to start killing men, women, and children, because that's the only way you can get underneath the tunnels, you can't do it from bombing from above. Right? So that was by design. It was a moral conundrum for Israel. What could we do post October 7th? We had no choice. We have to take our hostages and the captives. They need to be back with mom and dad. That's what we owe. Every human being owes that. But this is all by design. So again, you never hear people who criticize Israel say what I just said in the last 2 minutes, do you? They never contextualize the reasons for if there are these horrible deaths of civilians, and there are. And we don't take joy, God forbid. It's injurious to our souls and to the souls of our soldiers that they should take human life. It's not, for all the times we send out leaflets and texts and stuff, please get out, we're going to take out. You can't win. So it's by design. So again, there's no greater non-reality than what's being perpetrated against the Jewish people and Israel. I'll leave you just with this last thought. I heard somebody, commentator, he's not Jewish, but he talks about how right now Israel's being, and Jewish people are being accused of running the world, right? We run the finances. We run Trump. We run all the congressmen, except for one or two who deliberately don't take AIPAC money, you know. We influence everything behind the scenes. We did 9/11. We did, you know, Epstein was doing this. And it goes back, right, you can go back the litany. So he said, he's very funny, he just said, you know, if 50 million people in the world are capable of running our world, God bless them. Let them continue running the world because they're doing a great job. He was just being funny. Meaning if the Jews really do control everything, God bless them. Let them continue to control our world. So again, all this is non-reality. So what is our response? How do we approach Tisha B'Av? So I think the answer is to live in reality. And if we, on a personal level, will seek out truth and reality and teach our friends and our family truth and reality of our world, and our approach will always be based not on tears for fears, but on a real approach of what is evidentiary and what is in front of us, then please God, we can try to bring a little sanity and reality back to our world. So my hope, my prayer for all of us, this should be the last ninth of Av. And the next year, we're going to be celebrating parts of ninth of Av as a moed, as a holiday, as a festival, as a time where we came to terms with the past. B'mheira v'yameinu, amen. Thank you, everyone.